Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of the coronavirus on the world. My name is Richard McGregor and I'm a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we've been sitting down with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of the coronavirus, in this case, for Chinese foreign policy. The interview is one of a series of three that we're doing on foreign policy, and today I'll be speaking with Yun Sun, an expert at the Stimson Center, a think tank in Washington. Yun, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Now, look, I wanted to start with a general question. If you look from on high, China appears to be in conflict, not just with the US, but with many countries. Canada, the UK, Australia, India on the edge of military conflict, in Europe as well. Now, we always hear that the Chinese are great strategists, but I wonder, is there any strategy playing out here, or is this just the price that maybe China understands it has to be paid by a rising power?
Well, I think it's both. To begin with, from the Chinese perspective, they will not agree to the assessment that China is at war or at conflict with a lot of countries. They will say that look at how many countries there are in the world, and there are still plenty of countries in Africa or in Middle East and Central Asia, even for that matter, that supports China's cause. So in this sense, I don't think the Chinese will agree with the conclusion that China is being isolated and China is a minority voice in the international arena. So I think that's how the Chinese will look at this. And the second perspective that the Chinese have developed quite proficiently on this issue is that they look at the issue that they have had with these countries and ask the question that are these problems between China and these countries, or are these essentially problems between China and the United States? So when they look at, for example, Australia, they look at Canada, they look at India, and they look at European countries, one thing that the Chinese cannot help but notice is that these countries are either U.S. allies or U.S. close partners. So in the Chinese narrative, they don't see this as a problem that China has had with these countries. They see these are problems that the United States has instigated to pose these countries against China in order to isolate China and contain China's rise. Well, I don't necessarily agree to this theorization or this narrative. But for the Chinese, the conclusion or the inference they draw from that assessment is the essential problem is still the one between China and the United States. And if China can solve that problem, all these other problems will go away.
But I guess if we look out into the world right now, if we look at US-China relations, that's a relationship not improving, not necessarily in free fall, but one which has little prospect of getting better. If we take that logic, that means that China will have difficult relations, not just with the US, but with many Western countries, in other words, the world's richest countries, for some time into the future.
Well, I think that is true. And in light of this decoupling or selective decoupling between China and the United States, I think the Chinese has identified one essential vulnerability in terms of China's continued rise or continued development is the technological embargo. And if the United States treats other Chinese companies like Huawei and put China's whole high-tech industry on sanction, then China's continued rise will become a much more difficult endeavor, which is why that we are seeing the Chinese are reaching out very actively to European countries in order to maintain that alternative source to high technology. And this is featured most recently by President Xi Jinping's summit with European leaders we saw last week. And immediately before that, we also saw the visits to Europe by both by the top two diplomats of China, State Councilor Wang Yi and also Politburo member Yang Jiechi. So I think these are a coordinated effort of by China in order to avoid this isolation.
Can you give us a sense of the debate inside China on this, such as it is? You know, if you look at the US, there's a raging debate about whether Mr. Trump has taken the right approach or not on China. Certainly, we have the same kind of big debate for many years now in Australia about China. Can you give us any sense of different camps, if there are any, on how China should handle the US and the related challenges?
That's a great question. I think we all know that starting with Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese had maintained a posture called keeping a low profile to develop China's strengths while keeping a low profile so that nobody would see China as a threat. And a lot of strategists in China who are used to that narrative would argue keeping a low profile had worked very well for China. It has enabled China to develop its domestic economy and develop its strengths in a relatively friendly and benevolent international environment. So with Xi Jinping taking power in 2013, we see the Chinese foreign policy has become much more assertive. Some would say aggressive, and some would say progressive. But we are seeing China much more assertively flexing its muscle in different arenas. And this comes from this long-term debate in China that under Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, and Hu Jintao, the three generations of the Chinese leader, China had become wealthy, but China had not become strong. That China was not in a very good position to defend its position and defend its national interest globally because China was intending on keeping a low profile. So when Xi Jinping came to power, one of the premises that he has set for himself is that as China's top leader, he is going to make China strong. So if Mao Zedong made China independent, Deng Xiaoping made China rich, Xi Jinping will be the leader to make China strong. So I think that determination from the very beginning has determined that Xi Jinping's foreign policy was going to be categorically different from his predecessors, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao. And one term that we have heard a lot in China is 百年未有之大变局, the unprecedented change for a whole century. And what that implies is that under Xi Jinping, China does see itself as a rising power in the international community, and China is achieving an international status that had not been achieved by the previous leaders of the Chinese Communist Party. So all those judgments have significant implications for China's foreign policy behavior. And especially in terms of its relationship with the United States, I think one essential judgment that anchors all these Chinese shifting behaviors in the foreign policy arena is that U.S. is in decline. Maybe U.S. has not declined for China enough for China to surpass the U.S., but the power balance is changing quickly and noticeably. So the conclusion, I think, for the Chinese is that if U.S. continue to decline and China continue to rise, then this shifting power balance will have significant implications for what China can do in terms of its foreign policy.
So you think that's an increasing conviction internally in China that China will be more powerful and the U.S., relatively speaking, will be less powerful. You think that's becoming a much more a firmer part of policymaking?
I think when the Chinese top leader made that judgment, I think the whole bureaucracy is mobilized to follow. I have heard a lot of different opinions in China. Like people would say that if we are not strong enough to replace U.S. yet, why do we want to poke U.S. in the eye before we have surpassed the United States? But I think the counterargument that we have seen coming out of Beijing is that, well, maybe China is not yet strong enough to poke the U.S. in the eye. But maybe China has become strong enough to protect what China believes to be its legitimate interest in its neighborhood. So that's one origin of China's assertive behavior that we're seeing today.
Where do the Wolf Warriors fit into that? Now, in recent months, the Wolf Warriors have maybe gone back into their lair or their foxhole or whatever you want to call it. But they obviously, do they represent simply a strand of policymakers, or do they represent what you're talking about, a fundamental change in a sense of China's power in the world?
I think it is a product of the changing strategic assessment China has developed about itself, about its relationship with the United States, and China's role in the world. Even before the most recent episode of this Wolf Warrior diplomacy, which we saw most after the COVID-19 became China's almost most vulnerable issue in terms of its foreign relations. We also saw that starting from 2013, the Chinese foreign policy apparatus has become extremely hardline, to the extent that some people nicknamed the foreign ministry the Ministry of Non-Negotiation. So I would say that Wolf Warrior diplomacy is certainly not new, but the COVID-19 crisis puts that behavior on steroid.
Yes, so COVID-19, if you look back in the past 10 years or so, China obviously had a boost in confidence after the financial crisis, which it thought it handled better than the US, and it learned lessons from that. I think China initially might have had a boost in confidence when Mr. Trump was elected because they thought their system, meritocratic, as they say, threw up much more competent leaders. Are we seeing, ironically, with COVID-19, after, 6 or 7 months ago, people were talking about China's Chernobyl, it's very different now. Are we seeing with COVID-19 another boost in confidence of the Chinese leadership in their system? In other words, that it works better than others?
Oh, I think that is for sure, especially when China or Chinese people compare their own experience with COVID-19 to what U.S. has experienced. I think the sense of pride, a sense of achievement, or the sense of superiority is exceedingly strong in the Chinese society. I get sympathetic calls or messages from my Chinese friends, from my Chinese contacts, basically deploring what U.S. has done to itself. So I think that's a very interesting angle to look at Chinese foreign policy and how China, as a result of COVID-19, views itself and views its relationship with the whole Western world. And I think what we have observed is a conflicting view between two perceptions. The first one is domestic focused. So when China looks at COVID-19, although China has done a relatively better job, but COVID-19 still took a very big hit on China's economy. That if you look at the employment, if you look at the productivity, look at the suspension of economic activities as a result of COVID-19, and also on top of that, look at China's international reputational loss from the COVID-19. I think a lot of people in China would say that, China has taken a big hit. China's international status and comprehensive national power has suffered a pure loss in the COVID-19 crisis. So I think that's one more inward-looking perspective when people are assessing where China is as a result of COVID. But then there's this opposite view, that instead of look at China's absolute gains or absolute losses, they will look at the relative gains or relative losses. And the opinion goes like this. So yes, Chinese economy and Chinese foreign image have taken a big hit from COVID, but so did the rest of the world. And if you look at the losses that US has suffered in terms of its economy, in terms of its domestic leadership or international leadership, then I think the judgment is relatively speaking, China has come out of the COVID-19 crisis much better than the rest of the world, especially United States. So I think the two different directions suggest this conflicting view in China, and that indicates a lot of uncertainty regarding China's future strategic directions.
Yes, and I think we'd both agree it's some way to go on that issue yet. If we could just come back to something you mentioned earlier about a tougher line in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for some years, which predates so-called wolf warriors. There's the other theory, of course, is that the internal politics dictates external policy. In other words, internal politics dictates foreign policy. And the sharp domestic tightening, political tightening in China under Xi Jinping inevitably means a tougher line to the outside world. In other words, everybody has to prove themselves. Everybody has to get on the team, including Chinese diplomats. What's your sense of how tighter internal politics in China is affecting countries' foreign policy?
Well, that's a great question. I think it affects Chinese foreign policy at least from two angles. The first one is like what you mentioned. Well, after all, China is also a tiering system. And although it claims that it is a meritocracy, the judgment of the merit very much depends on the hierarchical assessment. So you are assessed by your boss. You're not assessed by the people or the people that you work with. You are assessed based on what the top leader thinks of you. So I think in that environment, it creates this bureaucratic culture or this bureaucratic tradition that officials need to cater to what they believe the leader wants to hear or what the leader wants to see. So that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The leaders want to see something, and then the whole bureaucracy is mobilized to present the leader that this is exactly the right direction, and it has been very fruitful and successful strategy. So I think this...
In fact, in that system, the incentive is actually to exceed what you think the boss wants.
And a lot of times they could go overboard with what the leaders actually want to see. And I would say that the issue of Taiwan is one such example. And the second angle that this has amplified or has impacted China's foreign policy is that once the whole system reaches that consensus, quote-unquote, based on the leaders, the directions that the leader has pointed out, it's very difficult for them to auto-correct. That even if they realize that there are problems associated with the general direction, they cannot say that. They can only blame the problems onto technical implementation problems.
Or blame the problems on the other side.
Or blame the problems on foreign hostile forces, which we have seen quite a lot in the narratives in the past few years. You're absolutely correct. So I think that basically made the auto-correction or the self-correction mechanism of the policy-making process dysfunctional.
Yes, well, that's a very interesting point. In other words, the only correction can come from the top. And let's apply that to one of the big issues for China at the moment. You mentioned earlier that many of the countries that China was fighting with were US allies. Now, that's not really the case with India. India has always had its own foreign policy. Xi Jinping and President Modi had a number of apparently fruitful, very lengthy one-on-one discussions. But here we find ourselves now with the two countries facing off each other across the border. Now, without going into the detail of different parts of the line of control and the like, that's very complicated. What's happened here and from what comes all the aggressive Chinese rhetoric against India, which seems to be very self-defeating in the longer term?
Well, to be fair, I would say that the aggressive narrative are mutual. We're also seeing a lot of nationalistic sentiment or criticism or even threats from the Indian general public towards China. So on that, I would say that they're mutual. On the issue of what is the essential problem between China and India, it depends on which angle you're looking at. So if we look at South Asia subcontinent as a region, I think people are coming to the realization that the structural conflict between China and India, both as regional powers existing or coexisting in the same region, are coming to maybe a breaking point. That India has traditionally seen South Asia as a sphere of influence. But with China's Belt and Road Initiative, China definitely does not recognize the exclusivity of the Indian influence in South Asia, which is why we're seeing China trying to build Belt and Road projects in basically all these South Asian smaller nations. And that inevitably affects India's threat perception of China and makes India suspicious of China's strategic intention. Then on the bilateral level, I would say that there are problems that neither side is able to make a compromise on. And these issues include, for example, the border disputes, as we have seen more and more frequently. There's the issue of Pakistan. There's the issue of Dalai Lama. There's the issue of basically how India sees Tibet, that whether India recognized Tibet as legitimately a part of China. Because people might want to recall that India did not publicly recognize Tibet as a part of China until 2003. So from the Chinese perspective, they always bear this suspicion that maybe India wants to do something about Tibet in order to restore this buffer zone between China and India. Then last but not least, the economics does not help. India and China, supposedly two great powers, they should have developed some level of economic interdependence. but it doesn't really exist in reality for Indian suspicion of the Chinese intention, and also for the fact that the power the trade imbalance between China and India is so severe that it makes U.S. trade deficit in terms of the percentage of the trade even less concerning for India than the imbalance between India and China.
So once there are a few problems with India, there's a potential for a lot of problems, in fact. And once the sort of the bond at the top breaks down, it appears that on both sides, there are many issues that people can stoke up, if you like.
Yeah, but I think then, I guess the question is there a love lost? Have China and India ever been close partners? Or there has always been this distrust, and the China and India had a border war in 1962. And basically since then, the border has never been tranquil. So I guess if we want to assess the China-India relations, the question is, what do we use as a reference point?
Fair enough. Now, we could keep going on India, but I want to move to what would appear to be a very marginal issue in Chinese foreign policy, but it's interesting from an Australian perspective. Instead of asking you about Australia and China, you're a long way from that. You've been looking this year at China and Canada. Canada is, in fact, a very similar country to Australia in many respects. There's a big dispute. They're caught into a dispute over the Huawei issue and the arrest of the senior Huawei executive, who's now fighting extradition to the US. Can you give us your sense of China and Canada very briefly? I mean, how is China managing that? How is Canada managing that? And what does that tell us about the broader foreign policy issues?
Well, that's a great question. I think the detention and the extradition case of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou in Canada has become the single largest roadblock for China-Canada relations. A couple of days ago, we saw the Canadians declare that they're going to drop the FTA negotiation with China because they didn't see this going anywhere. And I think the feeling is mutual, because from the Chinese perspective, nothing is going to happen with Canada until this Huawei CFO issue is resolved. But it put Canada in a very difficult position, because currently the extradition case is going through the court system. So the judicial process could take a couple of years. And does that mean that the two Canadians that the Chinese have arrested will continue to be detained in China during this whole time? And also, does it mean that the bilateral relationship will basically put in a freezer, not even a back burner, to put in a freezer for this whole duration of the time before this issue could be resolved? I think there's a hope. Some Canadians would say that the best solution for this, because this is not Canada's fight. If China has a bone to pick, China needs to negotiate with the Americans. If the Americans drop the extradition case, then Canada does not need to be responsible for the consequences. But the reality is the Chinese cannot force the Americans to concede. So instead, China is holding Canadians by their throat and forcing Canadians to make a compromise.
That's right. And of course, if you look back into the case about 20 years ago involving the famous smuggler from Fujian province, that case took about 7 years to get through the Canadian courts, and the relationship was hostage until then. Look, we have to end there. Thank you, Yun Sun, for joining me for today's discussion on Chinese foreign policy.
Thank you, Richard, for having me. This is a true pleasure.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thanks to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhardt, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode, and you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and stay tuned for our next episode.